There, do you have any idea what you're listening to?
London Philharmonic?
It's Venus.
Huh?
Venus.
Why not? We bounced signals off the moon's surface. There's no reason that Venus shouldn't radiate impulses.
I don't mean the static. Can't you hear it, the other thing?
What other thing?
Listen to it, Paul. Listen to the voice.
Hello and welcome to Media Geek. This is your weekly look at the world of grassroots independent media and our media environment. My name is Paul Rees-Mandel. Drew Tirico, the producer, is back at the controls. On today's program, we're going to talk about citizen media action in Chicago. We'll be talking to Mitch Shapanchik, who is part of an organization called Chicago Media Action. And they are doing lots of things to try to improve the quality of the media in Chicago, the accountability of the media in Chicago, as well as nationally. And he'll have some ideas about how we could do that in our towns everywhere. And also we'll get you up to date with what's going on in our media environment with Media Geek Headline News. Do stay tuned. Media Geek Headlines features news of our media environment about media economics, about media policy, media law that typically get left out of the electronic broadcast news and often are buried in the business pages of our newspapers. But we think that this news is important for all of us if we're going to understand how our media works in our environment and we can work to make it better and more accountable. The FCC is evaluating plans to require broadcasters to record and retain archives of all programs broadcast between 6 a.m. and 10 p.m. for a period of 60 to 90 days. In a response to recent concerns by the public and in Washington over broadcast indecency, on July 7th, the commission released a notice of proposed rulemaking to adopt the recording requirement. Presently, if a citizen wants to file a complaint over a possibly indecent broadcast, that person has to provide a transcript or recording of the broadcast in question. Without that material, the FCC will generally dismiss a complaint. In a statement, FCC Commissioner Michael Copps said that the purpose behind a recording rule is to shift the burden of proof off of citizens and back onto broadcasters and the commission itself. If the rule were adopted, then a citizen who filed an indecency complaint with the FCC, the commission would then demand a recording of the program from the broadcaster in order to evaluate the validity of the complaint. Most major broadcast companies already record at least all of their national broadcasts. However, this requirement would be particularly burdensome on non-commercial community radio stations, especially low-power stations. Unlike most commercial stations, which automate most aspects of broadcasts from a computer hard drive, community stations still air most of their programming live, typically using large stables of volunteer programmers. While many solutions exist for making recordings of broadcasts, also known as air checks, these solutions are not necessarily inexpensive nor easy to use. Maintaining an archive of 90 days' worth of programming would amount to 1,260 hours of recordings. Recorded as CD-quality digital audio on a hard drive, this would be over 700 gigabytes of data. The cost of equipment, media, and the administrative overhead could make it very difficult for community stations to comply with this rule. Low-power stations, which were designed to be very inexpensive to build and operate, would be especially burdened. Any member of the public is permitted to file comments with the FCC on this proposed rulemaking. Go to the FCC website, www.fcc.gov.
So it seems like this is sort of an attempt by the FCC actually to push broadcasters, and like you said, the burden would be particularly on community broadcasters, into sort of a guilty until proven innocent sort of ideal, right?
I mean, that's really what's happened throughout the course of this year since the Super Bowl, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is that we've seen this steady retraction of the FCC on the indecency front. It was almost 2 years ago that the commission released this long policy paper on indecency in broadcasts, outlining in detail examples of what it considered indecent and what it didn't consider indecent. And one of the things that comes out most prominently in this document is context and purpose. And so, whenever a broadcaster seemed to be making broadcasts specifically to offend or to titillate, even if they bleeped out offending words or tried to used other words standing in for words, but which obviously anyone with, above third grade could figure out, they would dismiss that and say it's still indecent. Whereas in one particular case that they did not rule as indecent, it was a news broadcast done by NPR, which was recorded phone conversations the FBI had of mob boss John Gotti, and mm-hmm. he's using the F word constantly, and they did not bleep it out. And the FCC said that in the context, this was not indecent. NPR said there'd be strong language, and it wasn't there simply for the purpose of titillation.
Mm-hmm.
However, the FCC's kind of backed up on that when they ruled that Bono using the F word as a adjective, really, mm-hmm. And accepting a Golden Globe Award, Bono of U2, they first ruled it was not indecent.
Right, because, they went back on it. And then
they went back and said, no, it is indecent. So there's been this real backsliding, this real big step backwards in terms of putting broadcasters on notice. I think this is just another aspect of it. This is another mm-hmm. opportunity to say, unless you can prove otherwise, we're going to assume you're guilty. To an extent, that has been true. In that, even though the FCC says they like to have a transcript or recording, in many cases, findings of indecency have gone on less evidence than that, mere descriptions, really? And the FCC has gone back and gotten transcripts or otherwise. And it has always been the case the FCC could obtain transcripts or recordings from a broadcaster if the broadcaster had them, right? Mm-hmm. And in the case of, like, a Howard Stern show, there's no way Infinity Broadcasting can claim they don't have the recording. Because they make them, they reuse them, they sell them. I mean, there's just no way to claim otherwise. But in the case of a community broadcaster, which airs nearly everything live, it's a different case.
Mm-hmm.
Again, it's a really easy way to say we're doing something about indecency without doing anything about indecency.
Where do you think this push is coming from, then? I mean, it seems like the FCC has sort of doubled back on itself in a way that it sees this opportunity to sort of, you might say, even exert its power over, because of the Janet Jackson scandal, and, Bono would have been ignored had it not been for this sort of uprising, of...
The push is definitely coming from within the FCC. Mm-hmm. I mean, Michael Copps, who was quoted in the piece I just read, is a Democrat. He's been at the forefront of being opposed to media consolidation, but he's made broadcast indecency and violence a key part of his tenure at the FCC since getting on, and he's been on since the Clinton years, and has been largely ignored on it by both then-Chair Kennard and current Chair Michael Powell until it became mm-hmm. a big political football. It's hard to know what exactly is going on. I mean, there's this element which, for a lot of broadcasters, for major broadcasters, it's not so much of a burden, since most of the programming is pre-recorded and gets recorded. And I'm not even sure they're thinking about community radio stations or public radio stations in the process. Again, it looks like they're doing something without doing something. And there's sort of a growing mm-hmm. sense on the more libertarian end of things, not quite right wing, but in the libertarian end of things, starting to think that this is part of an overall plan for FCC to get back into regulating content. And content, just in general, so not just sort of indecency, but to really be able to clamp down on things that are deemed to be undesirable, which is something the FCC was much more actively engaged in, say, in the 1950s and the 1960s into the 1970s. And it took a far more laissez-faire approach into the 1980s. Mm-hmm. And we talk about content regulation. I mean, it was indecency, but it was also with regard to things that were known as, like, the Fairness Doctrine.
Right.
Which required mm-hmm. that if, let's say, we made a statement about some particular political person or party or on any particular subject, and I said, I think that, George W. Bush is a moron, to an extent I should allow an opposing viewpoint or be required by law or by policy to allow an opposing viewpoint to come and be on the air. And so there's some people who think that this is overall push to get back into the type of regulation that used to mm-hmm. happen. And as with all regulation on content, there's pluses and minuses. I mean, many progressives have decried the fact that we lost the Fairness Doctrine because it meant that you couldn't have a Rush Limbaugh, practically mm-hmm. speaking. Because a Rush Limbaugh, to be able to counter that, would require a broadcaster freely giving up hours and hours of broadcasting. At the same time, a counter-criticism of the Fairness Doctrine is it just simply promoted bland programming. right? So right. You couldn't take chances. You couldn't go on a limb. You couldn't advocate for very much. And therefore, you know, most broadcasters wouldn't take risks. Probably the most famous example of an abuse of the fairness doctrine of content regulation was back, I believe, in 1970. It would have been 1972 during the Republican convention. The Democrats invoked a fairness doctrine, and this was pretty standard at the time, ability to counter-address. It wasn't actually the convention. I think it was the State of the Union address by Richard Nixon. And so it's very common for the Democrats to have, you know, if it's a Republican, to have a say in response. And it happens these days even. But then it was required by law. And then the Republicans said, wait a second, we're required by law to have a counter to their counter. And in fact, won it from the FCC, which, of course, being the head of the FCC is appointed by the executive, was probably not going to say no to the Republicans in that case. But you see, you got into these kind of weird political disputes where it seemed almost counter commonsensical that there be a response to a response to a response to a response. And so, you know, there is some merit, I think, to saying that, you know, content regulation is kind of a slippery slope, and yet there seems to be wide agreement that, you know, by much of the public, that at 8 a.m. or 10 a.m. in the morning, you really don't want to have what amounts to hardcore pornography on the airwaves.
Right.
You know, but, you know, it's an interesting issue, and the FCC is definitely being very reactionary with regard to it.
Yeah, definitely. So they're really looking to just avoid, I mean, you said that the fairness doctrine really just pushes toward a status quo sort of approach.
Very centrist, not very, you know, but and we don't know if that's what exactly is going on. Again, that's some people on one end of the spectrum are beginning to wonder if this is an overall push for content regulation, and even wonder if the backlash against the media consolidation is actually aimed at getting control. In a way, of course, we are concerned about content. Content is always something that concerns us. We're concerned that we get very biased media, that our local news doesn't do much. Real news is better at, you know, covering highway chases and fires than it is doing anything of substance. But it's hard to get at that with rules and regulations in some degree. And we see that there are correlations between ownership and what actually goes on in the air, or what is covered and what isn't covered. You know, and as there are correlations between, you know, Infinity owning thousands of stations and them having the Howard Stern show. It's not easy in any which way. In many ways, if I'm pushed to put on, I say it's more of a broken regulatory sphere altogether than it is any one factor. But speaking of a regulation, Drew, you have a quick headline there about our ability to make phone calls over the Internet.
That's right. It is a quick headline. But legislation has been introduced into the House of Representatives that would make voice over IP an interstate service and thus subject to regulation by the FCC. Sponsored by Cliff Stearns, a Republican of Florida, who chairs the Subcommittee on Commerce, and Rick Boucher, a Democrat of Virginia, who chairs the House Internet Caucus, the Advanced Internet Communications Services Act would place the authority for voice-over IP regulation with the FCC rather than with the states. The push for this regulation is actually coming from the big voice-over IP corporations themselves in order to avoid state-level taxation and regulation. Allowing states to regulate voice-over IP would result in a, quote, patchwork of premature, burdensome state legislation and regulations crippling the domestic voice-over IP industry, end quote, said Jeffrey Citron, chairman and CEO of Vonage, in testimony before a House Energy and Commerce Committee panel. Landline phone carriers that are subject to state regulations are responding in kind by lobbying against the act. They fear that the act, a protectionist measure, meant to coddle the new technology into a source of greater federal income and influence.
It's actually a really interesting debate when you think about it, because, you know, again, it's one of these things that the Internet brings forward because it is not a single-use network, whereas the phone lines, by and large, are single-use, although much of it now is now packet switch, which is the way Internet works, and works over these large high-speed data cables once it's outside of your neighborhood, once it gets to, like, the network connection rather than just the connection right out of your house. You know, and it really, they are threatened. Of course, you know, the same thing is that Internet, the cost of Internet, has already been borne in a local level by those local carriers. So if you have DSL from Ameritech, ostensibly they've already gone through the whole local regulatory politics of it, and you probably pay some tax, and I believe I pay some sort of local use tax on my cable modem at home.
Yeah, that's the last mile phenomenon, right?
Yeah, it's the last mile phenomenon. Of course, being a provider of voice over IP avoids the entire last mile phenomenon because it could just as easily be pictures or other sorts of data that go over the web. And so it's very interesting from a regulatory standpoint, you know, and shows you, you know, how challenging this sort of medium, the internet, is to existing telecommunications.
Yeah, it is, definitely. But, I mean, it's really problematic, though, because what you have is the federal government sort of reaching into an area that they've never touched before, and this is, you know, this is the internet that's been very much unregulated or deregulated, whatever you want to say about it. But they're specifically pertaining to just voice, you know, voice data as opposed to not picture data. You can download whatever kind of picture data you want.
And it's preemptive,
right? It is preemptive.
It's doing it so that the states do not. Mm-hmm. You know,
so kind of reeks of a political.
Oh, of course. Well, it swing. Always is, yeah, right?
Well, but I mean, a real political alliance between some the regulators that may be pushing this and.
But a point of comparison might be to say, well, what if they would? A similar sort of motion would be to declare streaming media like broadcast, and so the FCC had the right to regulate that. Mm-hmm. And so now, you know, you could consider, you know, ABC to be equivalent to some movie or some webcaster. Because currently, like, if WEF is a webcast, we could do whatever we want on it. So we could, say, bleep words on the air and let them go over the webcast, and there's no one to tell us differently, because the webcast would be the unregulated part of what we do. But a similar sort of thing could be Congress passing a law that says, no, the FCC will regulate webcasts. And so now all the same content rules that apply to the radio would also apply to webcasts. Whether or not that would survive constitutional scrutiny, any sort of judicial scrutiny, is a whole other story. But that would be a real equivalent sort of thing, and it helps us think about it, because maybe it sounds like, oh, great, you know, for them to protect or try to regulate, preemptively regulate this new sort of thing, but isn't necessarily a good idea. And it's also very interesting because it's the voice over IP people who are asking to be regulated. Mm-hmm. So for all the talk we hear of large industries about deregulation, about how they're being overregulated and how that they really want is a free market, here's an example of what they really don't want is a free market.
Exactly.
They want selective protections as brought on by regulation, and they use regulation against one another.
Mm-hmm.
So certainly Ameritech would like to have the state regulations because they've had they're used to it. It's more equally applied to them, and it gives them a competitive advantage, whereas Vonage would like to see to have federal regulations because it would be new territory and it would allow them to escape existing regulations.
Mm-hmm.
But they're all asking to be regulated.
Yes, they are.
I think it's very important to note that. They're not asking for true deregulation because that is the current status quo.
Yeah, that's right.
All right. Well, you're listening to Media Geek. I'm Paul Riesmanel. Drew Tirico's there at the controls. And we'll be back in a moment with some words from Mitch Shapancic and Chicago Media Action. You are listening to Media Geek, your weekly look at the world of our media environment, grassroots and independent media. I'm Paul Riesmanel. Drew Tirico has had the controls. We just heard a little bit from The Evens, which is the new band by Ian MacKaye, who is known for being one of the forces behind the punk band Fugazi and one of the seminal hardcore punk bands, Minor Threat. They performed at the Allied Media Conference, which I went to about 3 weeks ago in Bowling Green, Ohio, which is a great congregation of independent media makers from around the continent who get together and discuss ways to make media. And then this year there were some interesting performances, this being one of them. They don't have an album out, so I made a recording, but in full view of everyone, not a bootleg.
I doubt Ian MacKaye would really
just an independent recording. Too much. But also at the Ally Media Conference, I got a chance to meet up with Mitchell Shapanchik, who works with the Chicago IMC and Chicago Media Action. I've met up with him several times, actually, at the Ally Media Conference, and gotten to know him a little bit, both from as another indie media activist and as someone who is looking at media reform in his own community. And he's able to tell me a little bit more about what they're doing and suggest ways in which we can all help reform our
Chicago
media.
Action is a group in Chicago which is devoted to politics and activism pertaining to media issues. Among the things we've worked on, especially most recently and perhaps most famously, the Federal Communications Commission and the controversial media ownership policies they tried to implement, and issues pertaining to the FCC and making them more responsive to everyday people. We've also been doing work on the media, in particular in Chicago, especially public media. The main PBS affiliate, WTTW Channel 11, and the main NPR affiliate, WBEZ, which we've been pressuring in one case, in the case of the PBS affiliate, to actually kind of dramatically change their board to a more participatory, open, less corporate-funded model. And the radio station to actually get them to carry and air Democracy Now.
What kind of response are you getting from the two public stations?
In the case of TTW, we've been increasing the pressure on both of those. TTW, we actually have had a couple of meetings in the course of the last year with them about the issue, about issues that we've tried to raise. But they, even though they've talked with us and have been willing to engage in the dialogue, they've been precious little as far as the way in action goes. WBEZ has also been engaging in us, and the pressure campaign for that has escalated and gotten some media attention of its own in the last year. Not even that long. It's more like the last 6 months.
Like mainstream media attention?
Yeah. We've actually gotten one magazine article in a pretty widely read Chicago magazine called Conscious Choice. Actually had an article about the campaign we were a part of. And we found that, put it one way, I suppose the nut is cracking a little bit.
Uh-huh.
So hopefully it will continue.
And so when you say you've got these campaigns, what does that mean? What kind of action are you doing?
It varies. In the case of the WBEZ campaign, it can involve encouraging people to leave contents in the comment line to the tune of, some cases, about 150 different comments from lots of different people. In the case of
comments, where?
They would call a comment line.
I see,
and
I got
just leave messages there. Mm-hmm. And that's proved to have some impact. In the case of TTW, we've done everything from meeting with them to contacting the chairman of the board of the station repeatedly to get them to, even if they don't change policy, to at least acknowledge that there's pressure there. To do that. In the case of the FCC, and let me mention one example that's pretty recent, I and three friends drove from Chicago to Rapid City, South Dakota to take part in the FCC's Midwest hearing on localism in media. This is one of a series of meetings that Michael Powell, the chair of the FCC, had commissioned in the wake of the media ownership controversy. And he, as part of, I guess, expressing a sign of wanting to get more public involvement, it commissioned a series of hearings. One hearing of these six was commissioned for the Midwest. It happened to be in Rapid City, South Dakota. And so I and three others made the 14-hour, 950-mile, four-state drive to Rapid City to take part in the hearing, which itself lasted about 6 hours. And you can hear online. The entire hearing has been archived online at fcc.gov/localism.
What was the temperature there? Would you say that by and large people who came to speak, because they had like a public comment mm-hmm. area, were they by and large happy or unhappy with the FCC?
It depends on who you talk to, and it was widely variant throughout. I mean, there were some who were complaining, but their kind of complaint was, I can't get Monday Night Football, what can the FCC do about it?
Uh-huh.
To, say, local Air Force Base, Ellsworth Air Force Base near Rapid City, who simply could not find adjectives exuberant enough to praise the media for the coverage that they've gotten. From activists like me, who gave pointed commentary and criticism, to people who had the local, actually happened to be held at the South Dakota School of Mines and Technology. This matters because it turns out that the School of Mines' own radio station had its license pulled by the FCC. And so they asked the FCC, including the chair, Jonathan Adelstein, the chair of the hearing, mm-hmm. Who is from Rapid City and is a big reason why it was held there, to ask them can we get a radio station back?
Uh-huh.
And it turns out that it said, there's a procedure for doing this. We'll be taking comments. There's a window. The entire bureaucraties that he spoke.
And so, in the course, it's about you're doing all these different actions. You're focusing both on sort of the national media scape and the local Chicago media scape.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have a lot of volunteers, or do you work through kind of like a sort of a grassroots networking kind of model, or?
It'll vary there as well. We have a really active core of anywhere from, it'll vary, probably an active mailing list of about 20 people, maybe about a dozen of whom come to regular meetings. We have a wider mailing list of announcements and actions that we'll announce maybe twice a month, as well as monthly newsletter.
And that's kind of important for the campaigns. When you get
that's campaigns. That's a much larger, that's about probably 580 or so people so far. And if people want to join in, they can go to the website chicagomediaaction.org.
Now, do you have to be a Chicago person?
No, you don't. You can find out about these. In fact, we'll also highlight national campaigns. And also, we found that what we're doing is being replicated by other groups in other cities across the country. I know of groups in Pittsburgh, in New York City, in Honolulu that are doing or starting up the various kinds of efforts that we've been doing in Chicago. And so maybe Urbana-Champaign can also do the similar efforts locally or wherever communities happen to be. I mean, we'll get queries from across the country and around the world.
Well, it's been my experience, certainly, is that most people, even though they watch their local media and listen to it, have almost no clue about it in mm-hmm. terms of, like, who owns it, who runs it. Mm-hmm. In particular, one thing that I've done a lot of work trying to get people to know about is Sinclair Communications.
Yes.
Which owns affiliates in Champaign-Urbana. Mm-hmm. You know, they don't even realize, you know, that it's not owned in Champaign-Urbana or that the plan of Sinclair is to take away our local news eventually. Mm-hmm. Not that it's particularly good to begin with. Do you ever do any action regarding, like, local news, local journalism, and the commercial TV area? Because I know that there are some media watches in other areas that do that sort of thing, like Rocky Mountain.
Rocky Mountain Media Watch has been especially effective. As of yet, no.
Okay.
It turns out that, in fact, this had been one of the original foci of our, I guess, basically our blueprint about where we wanted to go. Something we want to do, not something we've done just yet. Mm-hmm. Something we hope to do in the future and may take up, but it's not something of a particular focus that we've taken up just yet. But no, it's worthwhile work, and where people can do it and do it with some success, more power to them.
So I think it's actually fairly impressive that you've been able to actually sit down with both the public TV station and public radio station and are willing to at least meet you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, although maybe it's a testament to how well you're working, and it's partly a testament to them, at least they don't completely dismiss you and
move
you off. But so what kind of answers are they giving you, though, since apparently they're not actually seriously taking your demands into account because they're not acting on them?
In the case of the PBS affiliate, the response, they'll answer questions that are kind of tangential to us, but they will also say, no, we have to put this in the hands of trusted professionals, and you simply are not trusted professionals. So we entirely put our hands in people who are supposedly capable of handling the matters. That's the PBS affiliate. In the case of the NPR affiliate, kind of, they'll talk with us, they'll talk with people who respond to this, try to give various answers about, well, we have to judge the matter more closely before we can be sure that we can make one decision or another, so we don't want to do it too harshly because we don't have a whole lot of wiggle room. I mean, in that case, at least they're trying to give some responsible answer of why they're not doing what we are hoping that they would do, and I can understand that. Mm-hmm. But also to understand that they may want to take our advice because that may actually help their circumstances. In the case of Democracy Now!, in fact, speaking with staff there who have worked with us in this organized pressure campaign, that they have, this show has proven to be a moneymaker for stations.
Right, in terms of pledge drive, revenues, things like that.
Yeah.
So there are actually people at the radio station staff members who would like to see change themselves.
No doubt true. And, in fact, people we've spoken to have kind of expressed that. It's hard to actually implement that as far as the structure of the station, but
right,
you keep working on it.
It's very much a top-down, structure in which, mm-hmm. Board directors and professional executives run the station.
But you'll find also some dissidents there as well. But, I mean, that's still, at least it's getting the cracks in the system. So you just keep hammering away. That's the way that anything the only way I'm convinced that anything has ever changed in this world, whether it be in media policy or anything else.
Do you know, does Democracy Now! Air on any other station in Chicago?
Just one, WZRD 88.3 FM, the local power FM radio station out of Northeastern Illinois University. University. And actually, the guy who had got the station to air that is actually a member of Chicago Media Action, and also happened to be volunteer staff at the station and successfully lobbied to get it on.
Yeah, and that's a much more open station. In fact,
yes.
We've talked to a couple volunteers from WZRD in the past, the Media Geek.
Yeah, I've some familiarity with the station myself, certainly.
So, and finally, is Chicago Media Action working with any other sort of grassroots media organizations in Chicago?
Some. There are some ties to the Chicago Independent Media Center, and that's kind of, actually kind of plays to the story of how Chicago Media Action came about. I'll refer people to the Chicago Media Action website as well as the About CMA. You will find links to stories about the... Let me just place the interesting teaser here. Involving an organized conference, an expulsion, and an arrest, which actually laid the seeds for what eventually became Chicago Media Action. The story's much too long to tell right now, but if people are interested, just go to the Chicago Media Action website, check the About CMA, scroll down, you can read the very long stories that were pertaining to it. In Chicago in the media, a local newspaper called Third Coast Press, where some staff of us also partake, it's a local monthly newspaper in Chicago. Affiliations with other various projects like the Independent Press Association, and not even just media, like the National Organization for Women. We've collaborated in efforts because they've spoken out very strongly regarding media as pertaining very heavily to women's issues. So we'll stand in solidarity with them and work with them as well.
And that's Mitchell Shapanchik of Chicago Media Action.
That brings us to the close of another edition of Media Geek. Media Geek's producer is Drew Tirico, and I'm Paul Riesmandel. The Media Geek radio show is free to rebroadcast by non-commercial stations for non-profit purposes. Please contact us for permission to excerpt. Email me at paul@mediageek.org. Thanks for tuning in.